I may interrupt you momentarily, we are going to begin with our lunchtime speaker. It is my pleasure to introduce to you that speaker. Don McGahn graduated from Notre Dame as his undergraduate institution. He has a JD from Widener, and he also earned an LLM from Georgetown. Since then, as all of you know, he's had a storied career, the highlight of which has been to be White House counsel under President Trump. He is now at Jones Day, where he is practicing election law. Ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to introduce to you Don McGahn. Thank you.
Thank you for the kind introduction. That was tight. He warned me, so I'm just gonna keep it short. I said, okay, that's fine. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today and speak to you all. It's a great group to be in front of. I love to leave Washington, talk to people who are not of the Beltway, because it recharges the batteries, so to speak. I'm actually a native of New Jersey, and mentioned I went to Widener, so I do pay attention to the Third Circuit a little more than other circuits, if for no other reason than I feel sort of a local tie to it. Today I'm going to talk about the landscape of the Third Circuit as it existed the day one of the Trump administration. Talk a little bit about the process of filling the four seats on the Third Circuit over the last 2.5 years. And then talk a little bit about the specific reasons why I recommended the four that are on the court now to the president. I'm going to discuss a little bit about the impact those judges have had already, and then talk a little bit about what the future may or may not look like. I want to start with some general observations about the White House's judicial selection process, at least during my tenure as counsel to the president. I've said some of this at a number of venues before, and some of you have heard it, so I'll be brief on this point. But it's clear, certainly now, looking back, that President Trump, as candidate Trump, ran on the idea of judges, and not just any old judges, but judges who actually are committed to the rule of law and a certain style of judging that begins with legal text, not with policy preferences and other things that had become fashionable over the years. He confronted a vacancy when he came in, was sworn in. Justice Scalia had passed. Senator McConnell did not move a nominee in the Senate, thus creating an opportunity for President Trump to fill what were certainly probably two of the biggest shoes that have ever walked into the Supreme Court. He also talked about filling the other judicial vacancies. Again, Senator McConnell very courageously held open vacancies at the end of the previous administration. So President Trump came in with a great opportunity to put a number of people that are in the mold of Justice Scalia and similar folks on the court. And on this point, I think there's bipartisan agreement. One of the few things people agree on is that the president did deliver on what he said he would do in the campaign on this, and he's done so time and time and time again. So the question that comes up is, what qualities did we look for in these judges? In one sense, I guess you can paraphrase Justice Potter Stewart. People only take half the quote. There's more to it, but you know it when you see it. And for those of you who are real scholars, and the sentence finishes, and this is not it. So it wasn't actually a test that allows subjectivity. But I say that for Judge Bibas because I'm sure he has the quote memorized. He nods, yes, 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 yes. He's looking at me saying I didn't quite get it right. So let's take a look, first of all, of how our internal process worked. Let's begin with how I was able to staff the White House Counsel's office. My principal deputy was Greg Katsas. He's now a judge on the D.C. Circuit. He had a tremendous amount of litigation experience, particularly at the appellate level. He had clerked for Justice Thomas. He was the assistant attorney general of the Civil Division, and then he was the acting associate attorney general under President Bush. He argued over 75 appeals. He was a partner to a major law firm, Jones Day, my firm. We were partners. And in many ways, he was one of the main intellectual engines of what we were trying to do. If you interviewed with Katsas, he could really cut to the chase rather quickly, and it was he was a tough audience to fake out. As far as the rest of my team, associate counsels had at least 10 years of experience each, which is unusual for White House counsel's offices. They tend to hire younger lawyers closer to graduating school or coming off clerkships. A number of people in my office had practiced law for quite a while. Some were partners in major firms and were willing to come in to be an associate counsel in the White House. Nearly all had clerked on a circuit, federal circuit court, and about half clerked at the U.S. Supreme Court. So I had a tremendous advantage in that I was able to select a number of folks who anyone we consider to be the best and the brightest. But in addition to their academic credentials and their clerkships, they did have practical experience where they'd been in courtrooms, some trial court, some appellate court. But when you have these experiences, it gives you a great sounding board to help you decide who you're going to recommend to be judges, because those of you who know this as practitioners, you can kind of spot a good judge and a bad judge. What makes a good judge and a bad judge sometimes is tougher to explain, but you get a sense of somebody. If you actually have had to be in front of judges, it gives you a good sense of the kind of questions to ask. But ultimately, the real decision maker was the record, and to a certain extent, the answers to questions in the interview. It was not based upon political connections or who you knew or that sort of thing. We really took a hard look at any sort of publicly available or semi-publicly available writings, law review articles. If one was a state judge, a number of circuit judges now were state Supreme Court justices, for example. We tried to read every opinion and everything that were written, and that goes from the Supreme Court justice nominees all the way down. And that ultimately was the thing that drove the decision. The president wanted the best, and I think he certainly has delivered that. So in addition to the clearly merit-based decisions, one lawyer on my staff, Rob Luther, who's now with me at Jones Day, published an essay in the Pittsburgh Law Review where he broke down the qualities we look for in judges to a three-part test. First, they must have an outstanding reputation. Second, they must be familiar with our founding documents, be originalist and textualist, and harbor a healthy skepticism of government. Third, they must have stood for principles and paid the price. All of that is true, but it begs the question, what is different about this group of judges compared to judges from prior administrations, including prior Republican administrations? I think three things come to mind. First, the selection process was different. It was run almost entirely out of the White House counsel's office, with some support from the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Policy when it came to prepping and dealing with various questions posed by senators post-nomination. It was free from interference from other offices throughout the administration. And what I had understood from my predecessors was at times that bogged down the process, where you had sometimes an over-reliance on political considerations, folks who weren't lawyers coming in and helping make the decision, folks who had not read the opinions weighing in on who judges ought to be. So very fortunate the president gave me the trust to actually centralize this in my office. So you had very experienced lawyers who had clerked for various serious judges involved in selecting future judges. Ultimately, too many cooks in the kitchen can make for a bad meal, and that seemed to bog down previous administrations from time to time. Now, that's not to say we didn't take input and recommendations from as many credible people as possible, particularly senators. I'm going to talk about that in a moment, but senators have a big role in who sits on the bench. But we also reached out to practitioners, sitting judges, particularly folks who had clerked. I was fortunate enough that the sitting judges would take my call and be very candid with me as to the positives and minuses of certain folks that had clerked for them. But ultimately, we did not view these as patronage jobs, and when it came down to decision time, we recommended who we thought were the best to the president. Second, my team was particularly concerned with the growing size of the administrative state. I've spoken about this quite often, so if you've heard me speak before, I'm going to condense it and not dwell on my usual riffing on administrative state issues. But generally speaking, Republican administrations of yesteryear certainly talked big on shrinking the size of government. But when you look at many of the judicial picks, Many of them were clearly comfortable navigating that environment, and folks are occasionally comfortable with wielding government power, and were deferential to those who did. A little bit different now, where there's much more of an emphasis on being skeptical, particularly of unelected power among these in the bureaucracies. Bureaucracies tend to grow. They tend to be self-fulfilling prophecies in a way where they tend to quasi-legislate, and then they adjudicate their own rules, and then they go to court, and oftentimes judges give them deference for things that are not clearly based in statute and seem to be an ever-shifting menagerie of factors and balancing tests. Third, this is the first Republican administration since former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid changed the Senate rules, requiring only a majority of the Senate as opposed to a supermajority of 60 votes to secure judicial confirmations for non-Supreme Court nominees. So rather than searching exhaustively for candidates who did not have much of a record so as not to offend anyone, meaning avoiding a so-called paper trail, which had been the conventional wisdom of years ago, this paper trail was exactly what we were looking for and what the decision was based on. So it was a little bit of a different model. We were not looking for stealth nominees or people who we just hoped were going to do the right thing. We wanted to see a real track record and a little bit of stretching out intellectually to see where people really were on how they would make decisions. Robust paper trails are precisely why the president nominated Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and the 40-plus Court of Appeals nominees that were made during my tenure. And the president was very, very adamant about this. He did not want to, as with most things with him, he didn't want to do it the old way. He wanted to break new ground, and was certain that knowing where people stood, not so much on particular issues, but how they think and how they write and how they digest problems was very, very important to be having successful waves of nominees. So how do we apply these principles to the selection process for judges for the Third Circuit? Well, under federal law, Third Circuit shall consist of 14 active judgeships. It does not require that any seats be attached to any certain states within the circuit as long as states have at least one active circuit judge. Something a lot of people don't appreciate is that circuit law, there's actually a statute on this, and each circuit has at least one judge from each state. When we took office in January 2017, there were two Third Circuit vacancies. Judge Rendell of Philadelphia assumed senior status in 2015, and Judge Fuentes in Newark assumed senior status in 2016. Although Judge Rendell went senior first, I want to start with the seat held by Judge Fuentes of Newark because, well, I'm also from New Jersey, and I want to get that out of the way. Trivia question, who was the first Court of Appeals nominee that the White House Counsel's Office interviewed? Anyone know? I'll give you a clue. Oh, his name tag is gone. Paul Mady. Received his resume from Governor Christie, actually, I think the day we entered the White House or shortly beforehand, and he was interviewed a few days later, and it was immediately clear he was precisely the sort of person that the president had in mind whenever he had talked about judges on the campaign trail. Judge Mady has an outstanding resume, but it's the kind of resume that's become fairly standard for a Trump Court of Appeals nominee. He's 47 years old when he was nominated. Actually, that may be a little old. thanks, that's an applause line. Laugh louder because the people on C-SPAN aren't going to realize that was funny. And that'll be taken out of context and it'll be, aha, we told you were trying to just get young people on the bench. So that assumes anyone watches this. I do. C-SPAN 3 at 4 in the morning. Fascinating stuff, I hear. If you have insomnia, it cures it. Sorry to interrupt Mady's resume. Top of his law school class and editor-in-chief of his law review, he clerked for a U.S. district judge. He clerked for a circuit judge. He worked in private practice at an elite law firm, served in the federal government for a short period of time, but served as a high-level counselor in state government, governor of New Jersey, and he accomplished all this in about 15 years. So he had a blend of academic excellence, clerking not just at one level of court, but trial court and appellate court, practicing in a big firm, and then being a very close trusted advisor to an executive of a state. You don't see this every day. One would ask, if he was the first we interviewed, why did it take over a year for the president to nominate him? Well, who gets to be a federal judge is not a decision that the president makes alone. It must be done with, per the Constitution, the advice and consent of the Senate. Today, it's not enough that the Senate as a whole support a nominee. So even if one, in theory, has the votes, that does not end the analysis. Today, home state senators have a significant say in who the president selects, and consultation with them occurs long before a nomination is made. This goes back 100 years at least. When I was in the White House, a member of my team found a series of speeches that President Taft had given after he had been president, before he'd become Chief Justice. I think he was the first Sixth Circuit judge, too, by the way. Taft's a fascinating historic figure that really talk about working in all the branches of government. But there was a section in there where Taft talked about dealing with home state senators and talking home state senators into people who would actually be good judges as far as the patronage job. So the more things change, I guess, the more they stay the same. So the home state senators have a significant say, clearly in district courts, but also in the circuit courts, even though not all these seats are necessarily tied to states. The Senate has developed this tradition that they are, so you have to engage with the home state senators. In respect to New Jersey, I tried very hard, probably harder than anywhere else, being a New Jersey native, to reach an agreement with the senators regarding the numerous district court seats there, the U.S. Attorney, the U.S. Marshal, and the Third Circuit vacancy. Unfortunately, we couldn't get it done despite even a personal visit from me to their office and significant efforts by my staff. Sadly, nothing has changed since I left. One regret I have and disappointment I have on the job was that we did not get New Jersey filled. 6 of 18, or one-third of the New Jersey District Court seats, some have been vacant since 2015, remain unfulfilled. Now, this is not fair to litigants, people in New Jersey and others. They do quite a bit of multi-district litigation in New Jersey. A number of pharmaceutical companies are based in New Jersey, so for jurisdictional purposes, a lot of lawsuits are brought in New Jersey. And you essentially have, a two-thirds of the bench, working, and I have been told they're getting quite tired. It's not fair to the judges, but more importantly, it's not fair to the litigants. So it's a shame that in New Jersey, at least, the senators just couldn't really agree to get something done. Now let's compare New Jersey with Delaware. Let's keep it out of Pennsylvania just to make it a fair fight. There you have two Democratic senators, so similar. But the way they handled filling district court vacancies could not have been more different. There were two district court vacancies in Delaware. We sent the senators the resumes of a few candidates we thought were qualified. They then came back with a recommended list as well. One of the folks we had recommended was on their list as well. So it made sense that was, and we also thought that was probably the best qualified. I think the senators agreed, so we recommended that to the president. The president made that nomination. And then we worked out the other one with a similar back and forth where we actually had very substantive discussions of the qualifications, upsides and downsides of the potential nominees, and then they were confirmed without opposition. So it's unfortunate that other senators can't follow the lead of Delaware and other states where it's more of a joint effort of the sort that the text of the Constitution contemplates. Now, coming back home here to the Third Circuit, in Philadelphia, we engaged in significant pre-nomination consultation with both Pennsylvania senators. I want to thank them both for the candor and openness. Both Senator Toomey and Senator Casey were very frank, candid, easy to deal with in the sense that there was certainly candor, and there were no games played or that kind of thing, which was a refreshing change compared to what I got when you go across the river. Our initial preference after speaking it over with the senators was to move forward with now Judge Porter of Pittsburgh. But then I learned that Pennsylvania believes it has opposed a tradition of replacing circuit judges with nominees from the same part of the state as a retiring judge. So that caused a little bit of a holdup, but it only was a 10-day holdup because 10 days in the administration, Judge Mike Fisher of Pittsburgh assumed senior status. So to avoid disturbing any real or imagined traditions, we shifted Porter into Judge Fisher's seat and then proceeded to search for a candidate from the eastern part of the state to fill Judge Rendell's seat. I want to briefly comment on the supposed Pennsylvania tradition of replacing circuit judges with nominees from the same part of the state. During my time as White House counsel, I never heard of this occurring in any other state. And upon further investigation, at least three examples of Third Circuit appointees in Pennsylvania made by presidents of both parties, Reagan, Obama, and Trump, prove that this is not something that can be properly categorized as a tradition. A little bit of a history lesson here. President Reagan nominated Judge Sirica to the Third Circuit when he was sitting as a U.S. District Judge from the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. to the seat vacated by Judge Adesir, whose chambers were across the state in the western part of the state. President Obama nominated Judge Vanaski to the Third Circuit when he was sitting U.S. District Judge for the Middle District of Pennsylvania to the seat where the previous judge's chambers were in Easton, which is in the eastern Pennsylvania, for those watching on C-SPAN, and who were previously, thanks for that laughter over there, appreciate that, and he was previously a judge in the Eastern District. So based upon these two precedents, it seemed like it really wasn't much of a tradition where it went back many, many years. Nonetheless, maintaining this idea of regional sub-regional seats within a state, President nominated Peter Phipps to the Third Circuit. He had been recently confirmed as a district judge in the western part of the state and elevated to the Third Circuit to fill the seat vacated by the other judge. Even if there was a tradition, there's really no constitutional basis for it. But leave that as it may, why did the president choose Judge Porter? Well, for starters, he fit the general mold of the quality of candidate that the president sought. He clerked for now Chief Judge Brooke Smith of the Third Circuit. He practiced civil and constitutional litigation in Pittsburgh for about 20 years, where he had an outstanding reputation for constitutional law matters in the western part of the state. But there's another reason why I think the president nominated him. I mentioned earlier that we actively sought out candidates who had stood for principles and paid the price. As a lawyer in private practice, Porter occasionally wrote op-eds on the controversial legal issues of the day, like John Ashcroft's nomination to be Attorney General and the suspect constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. He also wrote on originalism, property rights, federalism, and the commerce power, and has served on the Board of Trustees of Grove City College, which is well known for its principled refusal to accept any federal funds in order to maintain its independence. In other words, he was not shy. Unlike the so-called tradition of replacing circuit judges with nominees from the same part of the state, Pennsylvania has a real tradition when it comes to the selection of U.S. district judges. When the Commonwealth's two senators are from opposing parties, if they have been for a long time now, the senator whose party holds the White House essentially chooses three out of four. This is not uncommon. Other states have a similar tradition, New York, Illinois, and others, where they essentially divide up the judgeship, where the White House has a bigger say in a certain number, and the senators have a bigger say in the remainder. So in this case, Senator Toomey would have a bigger say in three, Senator Casey would have a bigger say in the fourth, and then the White House would have to sort of agree or disagree. As I understand it, during the Obama administration, Porter was Senator Toomey's selection for one of those package deals. Now, though Senator Casey may have ultimately given his consent, the Obama White House vetoed the idea and declined to nominate Porter. So much for the tradition of deferring to home state senators. We thought it was important to right that wrong and send a message that we would not shy away from candidates who respectfully advocated positions on controversial public policy questions of the day. That's, after all, what lawyers do. On the contrary, we welcome those candidates. The president wanted judges who are energetic, smart, and tough. Judge Porter demonstrated his toughness in the face of unfair media characterizations of his views, and that was a principal reason, I think, why the president chose to nominate him. Turning back to the other vacancy, the one created by Judge Rendell's assumption of senior status, one of the lawyers in my office had attended a lecture delivered by Professor Bibas at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. It was on the disproportionate power held by federal prosecutors in plea negotiations, and that caused us to think we should give him a look. I referenced Judge Mady's resume at the outset, and I'm going to reference resumes just once more because Judge Bibas has the kind of resume that's in a league of its own, even among his Court of Appeals peers. At 15, he graduated from high school. At 19, he graduated summa cum laude from Columbia University. He then went on to Oxford University, where he earned a master's degree and won first place in the World Debate Championship. Didn't know that was a thing, but I do now. While at Yale Law School, he was an editor of the Yale Law Journal and a member of the Moot Court team and won awards as the best oralist. He served as a law clerk on the Fifth Circuit and to Justice Kennedy on the U.S. Supreme Court. He practiced briefly at Covington and Burling and then served as an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District in New York. But he really made his mark as a law professor, most recently at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, where he argued six cases in front of the U.S. Supreme Court while serving as the director of its Supreme Court clinic. He has published books and dozens of law review articles on criminal law, most of which I read, and in one of the, if not someone in my team read them, and then I get to say I read them, and is one of the most cited scholars of all time in his field. But Judge Bibas is not only a leading expert in criminal law, he's the leading expert, I think, in the original meaning of the Constitution's 4th, 5th, and 6th Amendments. Like I said earlier, we were looking for originalists, so it should not surprise you that the President appointed one of the world's leading scholars of originalism to the bench. Finally, we have Judge Peter Phipps. He graduated from Stanford Law School, clerked for a judge on the Sixth Circuit, and started his career at Jones Day before joining the U.S. Department of Justice. Judge Phipps came to my office's attention as a Third Circuit candidate early in the administration from people that had worked with him at DOJ, where he had a reputation as the lawyer administrations of both parties could count on to volunteer for the hardest and most sensitive cases. During this administration, he served as counsel of record against an ACLU lawsuit to challenge the Department of Health and Human Services' refusal to permit grants that helped unaccompanied alien children being used for from being used for abortion or contraception. Based on his reputation for excellence in the face of adversity, we recommended him to the Pennsylvania senators for one of the U.S. District Court vacancies on the Western District of Pennsylvania. After earning the highest scores from the Senator's District Court Commission, the President agreed to nominate him, and he was confirmed by voice vote. I made it fairly clear at the time that Phipps probably was not going to be sitting on the District Court forever. That turned out to be true. He was just there about a year, 46. He's the President's youngest appointee to the Third Circuit. So now we know who President Trump appointed. The question becomes, how will these four appointees impact the law in the Third Circuit? Effects of judicial appointments can be measured in two ways, in raw votes and by interpretive methodologies. Because 28% of the active judges on this court are now Trump appointees, this change in personnel is going to change the outcome in a certain percentage of cases, if one just plays the averages. For example, last month the Third Circuit decided Northeastern Pennsylvania Free Thought Society versus County of Lackawanna Transit System. In this case, a group of atheists brought a civil rights action against the county, alleging that its policy prohibiting religious or atheistic advertisements on public buses constituted viewpoint discrimination in violation of the First Amendment. Third Circuit agreed, and in a 2-1 opinion authored by Judge Hardiman, joined by Judge Porter, the panel reversed the district court. The third judge on the panel dissented. Had Porter not served on this panel, quite likely the Third Circuit probably would have reached a different conclusion in a First Amendment case. Referring back to what I said earlier about methodologies, originalism and textualism are interpretive methods, and we took candidates' commitments to these methods seriously. I just referred to Judge Hardiman. He's one judge of the Third Circuit who has historically shown a strong commitment to originalism. We have seen this in two of his prominent opinions on the Second Amendment. First, in his dissent in Drake versus Philco, he concluded that a New Jersey law conditioning the issuance of a permit to carry a handgun in public on a showing of justifiable need violated the Second Amendment. And second, most recently, his concurrence in Binderup versus Attorney General, he concluded that the application of a federal law banning the possession of firearms was unconstitutional as applied to two individuals who have been convicted of nonviolent state misdemeanor offenses many years earlier. Similar commitment to originalism in the Second Amendment context was displayed by Judge Bibas in the recent case of Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs, Inc. v. Attorney General of New Jersey. There, the Third Circuit rejected a Second Amendment challenge to a New Jersey state law limiting the amount of ammunition that may be held in a single firearm magazine to no more than 10 rounds. In dissent, Judge Bibas writes that, quote, the Second Amendment is an equal part of the Bill of Rights. We must treat the right to keep and bear arms like other enumerated rights, as the Supreme Court insisted in Heller. So while President Trump's appointees have only recently taken their seats on the Third Circuit, their opinions are already demonstrating a serious commitment to originalism and textualism as a serious interpretive method. To recap, what qualities do these four new judges have in common? Well, they're energetic. Their average age was about 48 and a half years on the date of their nomination. They are smart. They all clerked for federal courts of appeals judges and practiced at the highest levels of the profession. And they are tough. They are committed to originalism and textualism, and their histories demonstrate that they are principled individuals who are not afraid to take unpopular or controversial positions. So what does the future hold for this court? If you count votes by the party of the president that appointed the judge, certainly a ham-handed way of predicting how judges would vote in actual cases, but it's really one of the few measures one has, the en banc Third Circuit is now 8-6 with Republican appointees in the majority. It's characterized by the media. This is the first federal court of appeals that President Trump supposedly flipped, but these numbers are deceptive. Although there are currently no vacancies, 5 of the 10 active judges of this court that President Trump did not appoint could assume senior status today or at some point during the presidency that will be decided by the 2020 election. There are two appointed by Republicans that are fairly conservative and consistent. There are three appointed by Democrats and are reliably liberal and also consistent. Of course, nothing compels any judge to assume senior status, but if a hypothetical future president picks potential successors, one can see the media declaring how the circuit has been unflipped. In short, elections have consequences, and the next one will have consequences for this court, just like the last one. President Clinton appointed six judges to the Third Circuit, four are still serving. President George W. Bush appointed seven, and five are still serving. President Obama appointed five, and four are still serving. While it is true that this administration's four appointees have made the Third Circuit more quote-unquote conservative, as the media would call it, than it had been in a long time, the outcomes of the next presidential election more likely to solidify the direction of this court for decades in a way that neither side has had in at least a generation. So thank you for your attention, the opportunity to be here, and enjoy the rest of the conference. Thank you.